Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight-up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Global from Asia, and have a happy Easter, everybody. I hope the Easter Bunny gave you lots of treats in your Easter basket. So for me, it was a startup weekend over the Easter holiday here in Shenzhen, China, and it was one of our most successful yet with over 140 participants, and we did it right in the headquarters of Tencent's internet company, which is one of the biggest internet companies in China. So, you know, doing these startup weekends is really inspiring to me as a business person to keep pushing myself and challenging myself, my own endeavors. It's just so full of energy. Okay, so in today's episode, we're in a different style than most podcasts. We did this in a live audience in Hong Kong at the Pods of the People event at the Premium Sofa Club in Shun Wan. And it was interesting to try this style, and I hope you guys enjoy. And, you know, hopefully, you know, that we did our best to get the sound quality there. We had Barrett Bingley, who is a master of B2B content strategies and marketing from The Economist in Hong Kong. And he came over to the event and did this on stage live with me. So here we go. Let's listen right in. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for being here on the show. This is Global from Asia. We run them weekly, usually releasing on Mondays or Tuesdays. It's about running a global business from Hong Kong. And we've had interviews with different businessmen and businesswomen from around the world that are kind of centering their companies around Hong Kong. They don't have to actually be in Hong Kong. A lot of people use Hong Kong companies, Southeast Asia, inside mainland China, even from the West. We are here at podsofthepeople.com podcast event in Hong Kong and a live interview with Barrett Bingley. So thank you for being here, Barrett.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
Great. And so, Barrett, we just connected a couple of weeks ago, and thanks for coming out today in front of our live audience. Do you want to just introduce yourself quickly to our audience?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm originally from Canada, living here in Hong Kong for about 6 years, and I'm the Associate Director of Content Solutions for The Economist Group. Most people know us for the newspaper, this comes out weekly, and some people in the business world know us for The Economist Intelligence Unit, which is our research arm.
Okay, cool. And how long have you been here in Hong Kong now?
Just about 6 years.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Perfect. It's a lot of experience. So today's show is about using content to build your awareness of your brand in Asia, specifically in B2B businesses. So we'll start off the questions with how do you, you know, tell companies to make their content compelling, how to make it interesting and sticky?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's vexing a lot of businesses, both SMEs and multinationals right now, because the trend is away from advertising in general right now and towards more usage of content, right? So we're seeing a lot of advertising dollars move into the content world. We're seeing a mixing of content and advertising. So this is really one of the big buzzwords in Asia right now. You know, 2-3 years ago, we never had a single conference on content marketing, and now they're just proliferating throughout the region. Certainly Hong Kong and Singapore are the hubs for this. So I think it's a timely topic, and making content compelling is probably one of the most important questions, because we're existing in a world right now where we're awash in content. So how do you stand out in that, right? I'd say the first thing you have to do as an SME or a multinational is telling a story. Mm. Perhaps the prelude to that is making sure you have a story, right? And then figuring out the right way to tell it. Having a viewpoint in business to business is important. There's a lot of companies that are worried about having a viewpoint, because that means sort of by necessity that someone's potentially going to disagree with you. But that's okay, because not all companies can be all things to all people. So have that viewpoint on whatever, you know, trend is affecting the industry, for instance. I would also say for compelling content in the delivery of it, you want to make it visual, but don't only rely on the visual stimulus. You need business people want to be able to get the quick take from infographics, from video graphics, things like that. But it needs to be seriously backed up with data, with analysis, or you're going to be found out. Mm-hmm. Right. So make your content quickly consumable and easily shareable, but don't skip the analysis part of it.
Meat and potatoes, maybe.
Exactly. Exactly. And I would say for B2B, I aim to make your content business, or perhaps even better, career critical. So whatever content you're producing, if someone who picks it up or if they're presented with a range of content that they could take some time to read, they want something that they say, oh, I really need to understand this or engage with it, you know, to further my business, further what I'm doing with my company, or because it'll help me in my career, right? And especially if there's some kind of like a competitive threat, like if they feel that their competitors are reading this and are going to know something, be able to implement something, that if they don't, they're going to fall a step behind, you know, so you're making your content kind of business critical. That's a really good way to make it compelling. Either that or go the opposite side and make it, you know, highly entertaining. It still needs to be useful, but especially if something's, you know, really just gripping and entertaining, people will spend some time engaging with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of companies are afraid, like you said earlier, about being taking a side in political, getting political or getting like maybe you almost being negative publicity. How do you kind of control that or advise companies taking a stand or a viewpoint?
Well, I think the companies in general need to be less concerned mm-hmm. about taking a viewpoint and just and realize that that's how they're going to help disseminate their content. Of course, you know, I work for the Economist Group. We have a viewpoint on many matters,
yeah.
So it's maybe easier for us to say that. Another way that some of our clients actually are able to push a viewpoint, but then at the same time kind of play both sides of the coin and protect themselves, is they work with us. So where, you know, a new index is produced or a new survey comes out, some new conclusions, sometimes if they're a little bit uncomfortable with that, they can say, you know, we have this neutral think tank look into this topic and this is what they're saying.
Got it.
Right. So that there's a little bit of that arm's length mm-hmm. That's created.
So is that common where they kind of want to get their viewpoint across, but not directly, is maybe through economists or other neutral parties? Or?
Yeah, I think it's common in as much as utilizing third parties to create content is pretty common. There's a number of other reasons for that, which I think are probably more germane, such as the you know, the expertise of a manufacturing company is in creating better widgets. It's not in creating consumable, shareable content. They might have a great story to tell, but do they have the people to do that? Mm-hmm. Probably not, particularly if it's an SME. Also, is that really the best use of their time? They may want to tell their story, but having someone else help them to create that story while they focus on sales and innovation is probably a better use of their time.
Got it. And, you know, being in Hong Kong, I think we kind of are the gateway between the Eastern world and the Western world. What would you say are differences in content creation that you've seen, if any, between like Asia and maybe the West?
Well, I think that the content wave, I suppose, has really been driven by Western multinationals. It's not surprising because you look at where did, you know, thought leadership and heavy use of content by business to business companies come from. It really came from the big consultancies, right? And that sort of came into being in the early 90s. And now it's been picked up to the point that just about all B2B companies are trying their hand at it. Okay. So like many other business trends, it's coming from a certain segment in the Western world mm-hmm. and making its way over to Asia. So what you're seeing in Asia is increasingly polished thought leadership, content, that sort of thing, from kind of a standing start. So they're picking up very quickly, but certainly the sort of best in class is still coming out of many of the Western multinationals. And now you're seeing a localization of that content for the local markets.
Sure. So yeah, that kind of gets into our next point is, how do you Western companies leverage their content? Like, is it localization? Is it purely translation, or is it, you know, viewpoints or, you know, cultural differences too in the content? How do you see companies treating that?
Well, it's certainly possible to use the content that's created, certainly the content theme or idea mm-hmm. in local markets. And, you know, you can treat Asia as a region and try to use it that way. But then you got to think about language and cultural differences, like you mentioned. You can split it a few different ways. You look at different levels of executives. Okay. In Asia, we see markedly different consumption patterns than I would say you see in North America or Europe. And what I mean by that is top level executives, they'll, so far from what our research shows, prefer to consume insights in hard copy and at very exclusive type events. All right. So it can be difficult to reach those folks through social media, through emails, that sort of thing. A number of top business leaders in Korea and China, for instance, still really don't even use email. Okay.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that, mid and upper management, not the most senior, are actually, we would say, much more connected than their counterparts in North America and Europe, right? So you got a big divide there. So actually reaching them digitally is extremely effective. Okay. So if North America and Europe are in the middle in terms of how effective is digital, which is one of the big delivery mechanisms right now, Asia plays both extreme there. All right. You mentioned translations, which is a good point. You might think, okay, we can produce some content and get it translated. But there's two issues there. One is that Asian business folks can very quickly pick up on content that's been developed for a global audience, frequently because things like surveys and others, when you drill into the methodology, the sample sizes for Asia, particularly countries other than China and India, which typically get a pretty large sample size, can get pretty small, right? Or you can see a very few number of interviews, you know, or no Asia case studies, right? So when you're creating new insights, you've got to tailor to the market at the very beginning, right? It's hard to go back and fix that sort of thing. And translation's not enough. When you do get to the translating stage, you got to, because it's, if you're dealing with business to business, you're almost certainly going to be dealing with a number of, you know, pretty technical terms. And you've got to work with either have people in-house, staff who can, you know, translate this properly, or work with a specialist translation company who really gets your industry.
Got it.
I've seen a lot of people make that mistake and they lose the technical words and it just comes out a bit gibberish and they lose the voice, right? And in Hong Kong, it's really easy to get pretty decent Chinese translations. Things like Japanese, actually very expensive, but worth the time, because the Japanese market certainly notices when a translation is off.
Got it. So you were talking also about the data, like India and China are massive populations, but I think maybe globally the analysis might not reflect their local market. So I just want to make sure I got this right. Would you, when you localize about Indian news, would you write the report more focused towards the Indian market rather than the global market, or compare India and the global?
Well, let's take a case of an SME that wants to create some content, some thought leadership, and use it in a number of markets, of which India or China is one of their major ones, right? They can create that global piece, which tells a story, but then they might want to create a separate subsidiary piece focusing only on that country. And if they don't do that, then I think the utility and the chance of that piece of content being shared in the business community goes down dramatically.
Got it. Yeah. So then you'd have a local team there that would, so it's not just translation, it's probably also like the data analysis and the market and the avatar, right? Or the reader who you're writing for.
Yeah, you either need to have staff, sort of local in-house staff who can help create this, or work with a company, a content creation company that has the capabilities to do it in market.
Got it. And then, yeah, it's really true about the email. Chinese never read email. And so when I deal with Chinese people, I usually deal with that on social media. So, you know, one big one is Sina Weibo. WeChat is kind of picking up really fast. So then you who distributes the content? There's the creation and then there's distribution. Is that
separate? Distribution is the other half that many companies still get wrong. Mm-hmm. Too often you'll see companies spend time and money on creating a piece of content and then it sits on a shelf. Mm-hmm. You know, it sits in their lobby.
Yeah.
And people walk in and go, oh, wow, that's really interesting. Well, I wish I had seen that 6 months ago. Right. That's you know, from a marketing standpoint, a terrible reaction. Right. So within Asia, certainly, as you mentioned social media, I'll pick up on that. You need to invest the time to understand which social media networks are being used by business people and you're comfortable working on across, you know, in each of the countries, because most countries in Asia is actually different. Mm-hmm. Certainly China has its own social ecosystem. Indonesia is vastly different from actually the rest of Asia. I would say Japan is a bit of a mix. And now you've got for the chat messaging, right? Because, you know, you mentioned WeChat. Okay, yeah. But then you've got WhatsApp, you've got Line, you've got KakaoTalk. So it's, you know, certainly you cannot just go with like a Twitter, Facebook strategy. Yeah. In Asia, right? That's not going to work. And you've got to have good localization of the language for use of social media. The other one to look at is, you know, you got to know your target market, figure out who are the media partners that you want to work with that are actually reaching the folks that you're trying to get your content out to. And if you don't do both kind of above the line and below the line amplification on this, you're going to miss a trick, really. It should be a holistic plan to distribute and amplify this content. Otherwise, you're just leaving value on the table.
Got it. Definitely. I mean, making is one thing and making sure the right people see it and write it. So I think people learn best by case studies.
Yeah.
Right. And so we've kind of gone through some basics here. And can we talk about a couple different industries and how they are creating content and distributing content? Maybe we can start in finance. Maybe if there's people in the audience that...
Well, actually, I'd like to ask the folks in the audience what industries you're in, and maybe I can tailor some comments to that.
Oh, I would love to. Okay. So I run two companies. So let's start with the first company. I run a Shakespeare festival in Hong Kong. So my main marketing source is online because I have no money for print media. Quarter Page in South China Morning Post is $13,000 for one day. Timeout for one week is $24,000. That's like half my budget for the entire festival. So I've been mainly contacting bloggers and social media people to get the word out about my festival, because we're like a locally funded produced thing. I'm trying to get more integration of how I can get more people to find out about the festival. So your advice would be great.
And what's the other company?
I run a blog.
Sorry?
I run a blog.
Okay. Okay.
The blog just hit 500,000 hits, so I'm not too worried. I mean, I always want more people to read the blog and more people to be interested in the blog. But seeing as the Shakespeare Festival opens on Thursday, my concern is, will I have a performance where I have more actors on stage than in the audience?
Wow. I will take a stab at that. Okay. Well, I have to say, I'm much more practiced at B2B content solutions rather than B2C. Mm-hmm. You say you're already using online. Have you invested in any video assets?
We have a promotional YouTube video that this man right here filmed for us. We're currently at 750 views. We were on TVB last week. Someone picked up on it and showed it on TVB, and we are on the RTHK website.
Okay. So what do you think has prevented you from getting more than 750 views in a city where you would think that if...
I'm not really sure because we did a YouTube video last year for our play, and during the play, it only had 1,000 views, but a year later, it shot up to 50,000 views.
What if, would somebody like Megan and her business then get in touch and market better to companies for potentially selling block tickets for an event like that?
Because I tried that and I got nothing.
Yeah. Now, corporate sponsorship is something I can talk a little more about. When you're talking to companies about corporate sponsorship, I guess when you go in to pitch them...
I couldn't even get in the door.
Right.
They wouldn't even answer my email. I sent out 150 emails, and I got a reply back from two to have a meeting with them. And the other two meetings, they were like, well, let's see how the first year goes. And if that goes well, we'll consider investing in the second year. So we did our first year totally on crowdfunding because it was the only way we can actually get the funds we needed to start off.
Yeah.
So you
actually got 1 year under your belt.
Yeah. We opened next week.
Okay. So you should be able to create a pretty strong pitch deck, because when at the first contact with the corporates, you are not trying initially to get a meeting unless, you know, you're pretty well known as a brand, which it sounds like you guys are not, right? So you've got to let, because of, you know, time constraints, you've got to let your material speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got to provide them with a deck and maybe video assets that show them, that kind of bring to life, what is this event actually about? Okay. And it makes it safe for them. This is one of the things that immediately they'll be concerned about, I think. It makes it safe for them to feel like they want to be associated with this. And then you've got to make it very, very explicit to them what that benefit is going to be, right? Now, I don't know how your festival is pitched, but if you're going after an audience of, you know, high net worth individuals and that sort of thing, and you're going out pitching private banks, mm-hmm. you need to quantify that to them. How are they going to realize those benefits? How are they going to turn that sponsorship into lead generation and then into relationships and sales? You may not get, like you said, it was hard to get meetings, right? This is where a short pitch deck, they're much more likely to open that up. It takes a little bit of time with it to go through it.
What actually is a pitch deck? I don't know what this term is.
So it's basically you can use PowerPoint, you can use whatever, Keynote, to create something that's going to showcase what is your event, what is the success you've already had with it, how does it fit with the corporate? So you have to customize it a little bit with each one.
Okay, so build a PowerPoint.
Build a PowerPoint deck, but the reason I call it a pitch deck is you're showcasing your product, you're showcasing what content is going to be showed, and then what benefits they're going to get. This is not, I have to say, this is not content creation, but if you're going with video assets, then that's the content side of it, because you're going to try and bring to life the event for them and show them why it's really cool and going to be beneficial to be associated with it.
Like another idea is an infographic or data from your previous event.
Again, you use these terms. I don't know what they mean. Infographic. What the heck is that?
Okay. Infographic is kind of like a pretty like pie charts and graphs. Usually it says like a image online.
Okay. Charts. I understand the word chart.
Charts. Okay. So yeah. Make charts like last year, how many people went? Were they male, female? What's their age? What's their income level? As much as you can explain about your target market.
Okay.
And then sell those people to those sponsors and say, this many eyeballs saw my, went there. Your logo will be next to these kind of people. Because their companies want to target their demographic. So you have to sell them on matching their target market with your audience. Mm-hmm. So in a pitch deck, you have like an infographic about your demographic and your attendees, and also maybe like write up some reports. That's kind of like economists' specialty is making these reports that kind of take data and make like research reports. And
yeah, I think
it might be hard for
an infographic, just to simplify it, is really you're taking different data points and using things like bar charts, circular charts. You're putting them with kind of eye-catching graphics so you can present the story of your event in a one or two page graphic. And you're going to get better engagement with that than you are with like a list of bullet points in an email, because it's a natural that people will skim through emails, especially if they're getting it on their mobile and, you know, file it away in the never box. Right. Whereas if it's actually quite a cool eye-catching infographic to a company, you know, a person's based here, I think you're much better. That so far, all the projects we've done and the research that we've done, so is the infographic, did a much better retention and action.
It's kind of like people in Hong Kong want to read my Tumblr. They don't want to actually read my blogs. They don't like reading.
That's kind of it.
Yeah. Okay.
But like I said earlier on, it's got to be backed up with the data. So from your first event, go back and look at not just how many people, but if you can, you know, what are their income levels? What are their interests? What's the psychographic beyond?
What's a psychographic?
Psychographic is what are people interested in? What are their aspirations? What type of media do they typically consume? What are their political opinions? So demographic is the hard things like how tall are they? You know, how old are they? Where are they from? Psychographic is their mind.
All right. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, cool. Maybe another case study, another industry.
Yep.
Let's get the mic over.
I'm interested in health and education in Hong Kong and China. So maybe if you've done projects in that space, you could talk about it.
Yeah. We've done a fair number of projects, actually, health education, because they're, you know, the big growing industries here. Let me think about on the health, like health technology. Okay. That's what I would talk about. If you're in the healthcare business, maybe you've got a new technology, new product you want to bring to market. It's something that, as a Western company, you develop, but there's not a huge amount of recognition of what the benefit is here. Okay. So the temptation by a lot of companies, and this is true in the healthcare sector, this is true in the tech sector and quite a few others, is to talk directly about, you know, the benefits of your product. Right. And that's a very, you know, sales focused drive. Okay. And that certainly has its place, but people don't always want to be sold to. And frequently, healthcare technology products are riding on the wave of a larger trend, all right? And so maybe that trend is quantified self, okay? Like the Nike Fitbit, that sort of thing. Maybe the trend is mobile. Maybe the trend is around big data, right? I've actually seen healthcare products based on all of these big trends, okay? You want to sell these up in China? Maybe the people that your clients, they aren't, you know, they're, they have a glimmer of awareness of these big trends, but their day-to-day life, they haven't really been able to explore them. So one way I think about going about, you know, creating new engaging content would be to tackle one of those big trends. Okay. Maybe what you don't want to do, create a survey of how are people, you know, the people you would like to be your clients. Okay. So how are they reacting to this big trend and taking advantage of it or not? How aware of it are they? And if they are aware of it, how are they taking advantage of it or not? You know, you've got to create a survey. You have to decide on, you know, what types of industries are your buyers in for health, right? Are you going after governmental? Are you going after actually like the hospitals? Are you going after the education system, depending on, you know, what your product is? Then you want to look at, you know, how big of a size are you going after? The SMEs? Are you going after only the Chinese multinationals and maybe the Western multinationals operating in China? Okay, so basically get the demographics of your survey down. conduct the survey, draw out the conclusions from it, turn that into an executive summary, maybe talking about an infographic, get it translated into Chinese if you haven't done the research originally in Chinese. Then I think what you can do with that is then create, if you've got the budget for it, a series of like sort of client fora. Okay, you get people together for breakfast, lunches, you get the folks who are like instrumental in creating the research to come talk about the research. And then at the end of that, you can hit them with the sales pitch. So then you prepare some special sales material talking about, okay, this is the big trend around quantified self, right? This is what's happening in China around it. This is what's happening in the rest of the world. Here's how people in China are reacting to it or not. Okay, so we've had this kind of interesting conversation. Then you come in and talk about, this is our product. Here's how we're going to help you solve that problem, help you to make money or reduce your turnover or, you know, improve the health of your workforce, whatever it is. So that's a pretty typical content strategy. Take a big trend, create some illuminating insights on it, have some events around it, and then link it directly to the solution that you're selling.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
It can be. If you pick the right trend, then you can really hit a bubble and you can get some pretty good media coverage on it as well. I would say to make it more fun, the better the data is, it's going to be more enjoyable. You actually get some really interesting insights. We conducted a survey recently for a financial institution where we actually found that the opinions of the Western companies that we interviewed in terms of what are the most important changes to come in China and the opinions of the in China executives were polar opposites in terms of one felt that a certain change in the financial sector was the most important thing that had to happen for, you know, China to advance. And the Chinese executives felt the exact opposite. This thing probably never needs to happen whatsoever. That sort of thing can generate some pretty good headlines and is quite fun to talk with clients about, you know.
Cool. So
you're not going to tell us the difference of opinion?
The difference of opinion was actually around whether China needs to privatize and reform its banks in order for the financial system as a whole to reform. And or are there other aspects of the financial system that need to be reformed first? So the Western executives felt the banking needed to be tackled first and immediately. And the Chinese executives basically said, if the banking system is not reformed or is reformed last, that's probably fine with us.
So I do internet marketing. Like, I'm more of an internet marketer myself. So I think from my standpoint is content is king, is what they say in internet marketing. So creating good content is really what drives awareness and branding, which is what we're talking about today, especially in B2B. So I have some kind of questions that came up about surveying. So a survey, mm-hmm. A little bit of feedback here, I think, but surveying, who can you survey and how many is it? Like, can I just call people up or just go outside in Hong Kong and, you know, with a clipboard and ask people? I mean, how do you conduct, maybe for bigger companies might be bigger budgets, but maybe for some people here are smaller, but maybe some ideas of surveying.
Well, there's a few ways to go about surveying for SMEs. I mean, most of the big companies will outsource their surveying to companies like ours or local companies who do it. I think that for SMEs, if they've been in the market for a while, probably one of the best ways to do it is to go with a customer survey, but you need to get your sales folks involved in that because just an email, you'll probably get a pretty dreary response. Mm. So you really need to rely on the personal relationships to make sure that those surveys get filled out. Probably another possible way, if you're a company that has a fairly strong social media presence, would be to do it that way. Those are probably the least expensive ways to do it. You then still need to have somebody who can collate and interpret the data in a robust way. If you're thinking about doing a survey, you need to think about not only how to get it done, but how to analyze and then present the data.
Got it. And then I guess it depends on the survey, but how many responses do you think is generally enough to make it worth it?
I think from a statistics point of view, you really don't want to put out any content that has a survey sample of less than 200.
Okay.
Right. And if you want to use that survey to talk about specific industries or countries, you probably want a sample size of at least 100 for each one of the significant groups that you're talking about. So if you're doing like a Northeast Asia survey, you probably want to try and get 100 from Japan, South Korea, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, right? And maybe Mongolia, if you want to include that, but it could be hard to get that sample size. So that, you know, that can bring the numbers up. Most surveys that we see in the industry are in the mid-hundreds.
Mid-hundreds. Okay. I think that, you know, I think that's possible for an SME maybe if they send out an email and then they follow up and maybe do social media. I guess you can combine it all as one, or would you, the source or?
You can combine it all if you're able to get demographics from all the folks who are answering the survey and you're making sure that they're answering the same survey questions. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you have to be a bit strict in the methodology, but you should be able to combine the results.
Okay, cool. So yeah, and then you also mentioned in your case study is, you know, add value first, you know, educate your customer and then pitch them, right? You don't want to like sell your product or service right at the beginning. So by doing like kind of more valuable content and then later kind of hooking them in to buy your product or services is a more.
I would say the phrase to remember is engaging insights, okay. Right? So work towards creating something that your customer actually cares about reading. That's the insight portion, and then present it in a way that's easy for them to care about, for them to get excited about, for them to share. That's the engagement part. Just actually, because you asked me about the surveys and you want to talk about engagement, one of the things that we will see people do, and it's not difficult to set up, is creating an online benchmarking tool. So you've gone to all the trouble to maybe create a survey or an index, that sort of thing. You got numbers behind it. You want to put it out. Now, you not only want people to read this, but the idea of getting them to read it is that they're implicitly comparing themselves against the people who took that survey, right? That's the idea there. Yep. And then you're trying to get them to realize, oh, we're behind the curve, for instance. We need to talk about this, you know, this big data solution or whatever it is. And a way to get them to explicitly engage then, put a benchmarking tool on where the person who's got that survey can now go online, take that same survey, and then tell you who, you know, what industry they're in, how big is the size of the company, where are they headquartered, that sort of thing, and then get their scores against their peers. Okay, people always like to be, they'll always like to see how are they doing against their direct peers, right? It's a competition thing. It's a sort of in-group thing. And the process of that, by getting them to register in order to take the benchmarking tool, you've got all the details, and you can use that directly for lead generation. So there's a sort of dual rationale for having that sort of a tool available. Cool.
Yeah, that, I mean, I'm learning from this. So basically you put something out there that maybe is going to challenge them that we're falling behind against our competitors. Like the new trend is, you know, mobile apps for healthcare and everybody's doing it, but I'm not doing it. So maybe, oh, I can fill this form out, this benchmark, and then I fill it out. I put my email address, my company, you know, and then it goes to the content creator and they get the data, they get the contact details and they're like email marketing, engaging with them. And then
ideally that registration data doesn't even go to the folks who are responsible for creating the content. It's just streaming right to the salespeople.
Okay.
Okay. And then the content folks are at the end or basically real time if you can, but minimum at the end of the project are getting an aggregate of that data because they don't necessarily need the individual names and email address. What they need is an aggregate report showing how engaging was that content, how many people saw it, how many people downloaded it, how many people went on registered for the benchmark tool, all those sorts of things. Because you can then use that to tweak your next project, you know, try and rectify any weaknesses, come at it from a different angle, what have you.
Cool. Should we try another industry or see if...
Yeah, any other industries?
Well, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the dichotomy and the languages here in Hong Kong. And whenever it comes down to content creation or the companies that you're working with focusing on the Chinese or the English, is it a hybrid? What are they looking for? And then what are you finding is successful for them?
We get asked this a fair bit in terms of should we, for Hong Kong, okay, if you want to keep it just focused on Hong Kong, how important is English versus simplified Chinese versus traditional Chinese? And actually, we get asked about Taiwanese localization as well. We find for the business community, to a large degree, English works. That might be because a lot of companies we work with are targeting very senior level executives who are typically active within the whole region, and therefore their English level is pretty high. That being said, if you're targeting a lot of the Chinese companies that are using Hong Kong as their base to go into the world, the executives, I think, are more comfortable reading in simplified Chinese, particularly if you're trying to get it at the C-suite. So I think it's worth investing in that. At this stage, unless you're really targeting smaller SMEs in Hong Kong, I'm not sure the utility of translating into traditional Chinese or, you know, localization at the moment. Now, if you have the budget for all of it and you have people who will actually help disseminate that to each of those kind of language markets, great. But if you have to make a choice, probably English and simplified Chinese works best.
Okay. I'm not sure how we're doing for time, actually. Okay. We're actually right at an hour. Okay. So I think we kind of went through case studies. Maybe how can people reach out to you if they want to follow up or?
Yeah, certainly. People happy to talk to folks, different industries who are, you know, getting into Asia. And best way definitely is email. It's BarrettBingley@economist.com. Okay. Two R's, two T's. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you guys for being here, the audience. And we'll have this on online at globalfromasia.com in a couple of, hopefully mid next week. Travis. Thank you.
Don't forget to follow Barrett on Twitter.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Barrett HK.
Barrett HK.
Barrett, you got any other things going on? Like, I know you did, you went on a tuk-tuk all across Southeast Asia one time, a huge week-long trip or maybe longer than that. Anything lined up like that?
No, that was a different life, Travis.
No more of that.
All right. That's a wrap.
Thanks.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Barrett. I really enjoyed this episode for my own internet marketing knowledge and toolkit, especially that idea of finding trends in your industry, making surveys, publishing it, and then doing an event to get leads and get other people in the industry to notice you and engage with you. I really learned from that, and I think it's really valuable for everybody. So this Pod to the People event was a lot of fun for me. I'm glad there's other podcasters out here in Hong Kong and different industries and categories. And thank you, Travis Jones, for putting this together. And hope we can keep these going on a regular basis. All right, guys, until next week's episode, that's a wrap.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe.